I welcome you to the Family Life Committee of Trinity United Methodist Church Small Group Seminar on family and marriage. I propose to get immediately into the subject. This is not a church service, and I just simply ask you to hear me as I endeavor to lay the groundwork, because that to me is the most difficult part, is getting people on board. It's much easier to deal with answers to the problems than it is to pinpoint the problems, because people today just aren't aware of what's really eating away at the central core of the home, of a good marriage, and what's causing so much real misery within a marriage. And I just need to say, and I've thought about this enough that I'm prepared to say it without any sense of being apologetic at all, the single most prohibitive thing in announcing a subject like this is that by announcing it, you're already offering more than you can give. And so it becomes a matter of subjugating one's ego and saying, okay, this is a tremendously vital subject, and so you go ahead and give it, and then you do the very best you can and share the best you've got and the best you can, and that's what I intend doing. I don't qualify as an expert on marriage. Having been married almost 24 years, I know enough by now to know that I don't know much about marriage. The only real experts on marriage are priests. And you know, the thing that surprises me is that some of those guys really have some pretty good things to say. But the only real experts are priests. The only real experts on raising children are those that don't have any. So I propose to do precisely what I do on Sunday morning, and that is just share some things that have helped me. And I want to say that this is going to be a helpful series. I know that for two reasons. Number one, I have stolen from the best sources. I have not taken from anyone who was second class, but the very best. And secondly, it has communicated to me. And I want to encourage you to make some time commitment to this, because in any one session or in any half session of one session, there are going to be things that aren't going to meet your needs. And I particularly call your attention to the fact that this is a specified, stated premise, the subject for these six sessions. The title is The Care and Maintenance of a Good Marriage. It is a preventive type concept. And of course, I come from the standpoint that I find in my own life and in my own ministry, most of the couples I marry are good marriages, and most of the divorces I have to preside over are good marriages. And some very recent years ago, I began to ask the question, what's happening to good marriages? Good marriages are failing today at a rate faster than anything I've known in my 45 years. And I think one of the most creative things we can do is ask the question, why do good marriages fail? Now, I want to deal with that premise tonight. Why, according to the people I read best, and also mostly my own observations, mostly, I want to talk about why good marriages fail. And then I'd like to spend the remaining five sessions on the subject of basically what you do about it. I'm not saying there won't be any of that tonight. I'm just saying that I'd like to get that introduction established. Then session two is on identifying and raising the little you. Three, how to scratch the 20-year itch for those of you who've got it and those of you who've got it coming. Number four, sex isn't just for babies anymore. And number five, it never was. And then session six is on keys to keeping a good thing going. I would like for you, one of the complicated things I feel about this, as we get started, is I had hoped for interaction. Just to sound borderline presumptuous. I have tremendous confidence in what I'm going to say. I've just never said it more than one person at a time over the last 18 years, except for an occasional family life seminar here and there. So I hope you will interact at any point you feel you can. Those of you who go to church here, which is most of you, know that that happens occasionally on Sunday morning. In this church, nobody cares what you wear or what you say or who you are or who you aren't. So perhaps you could help some of my anxiety by simply reacting with me, particularly at the point of sharpening up some of the simplistics and some of the generalizations, because there's no way you're going to get at the heart of every problem, even with all the six sessions, obviously and clearly. But I want to begin with the assumption written by Richard Farson from the University of Chicago Behavioral Science when he says, "The better a marriage is, the worse its partners will sometime feel. It's a paradox we've got to learn to live with." And I have found in my years as one involved in counseling that it's the good marriages that often fail more than the bad marriages. Bad marriages are oriented that way. It's an enchromatic thing, generation to generation. Nobody knows any better. They don't feel anything strong. There's no great peaks. There's no great drops. It's just pretty much of a straight line. And the real thing that's frightening today is that people are assuming that if you've got a good marriage, it's always going to be a good marriage. And yet there comes the seventh year of the marriage, the 14th year, or the 21st year, or the 28th year, those strange increments of seven, where we see so many of our friends divorcing. And you know, at my age, so many of the people I know who have friends our age are appalled at how much divorce is going on. Some of the most current statistics, and in fact they haven't changed in the last decade, say that 50% of all marriages in this country are ending in divorce now, but that in the American home, 80% of those homes are to some degree unhappy, all the way from just sort of unhappy to borderline on the rocks. Now, what's causing that? Well, somebody began by putting it this way. Marriage is a funny gamble. Everybody wins or nobody wins. And that's something of the thing that I want to try to get at. The general rule is this. People who enjoy life enjoy marriage. Now, what's important about that statement is that you just can't walk into a session like this, and I'm not saying this for my own protection. You just can't walk into a session like this and say, "Give me a magic wand. Give me something that'll make my marriage work out when it hasn't been working out. Give me 3 points in a poem, give me a scripture verse, and let the whole thing be right." You may have some very real neurotic problems in your own personality. You may be borderline psychotic. You may have some problems from very, very early childhood. And a lot of those I want to try to deal with, and not the way the experts do. I want to say them the way I've been saying them in private with other people. But I want to say that people who enjoy life generally enjoy marriage. And people who do not generally enjoy life do not generally enjoy marriage. So kind of lock in on that, because it'll help us as we go along through this session and all the rest, because you don't change personality until something really drastic, either clinically or religiously, spiritually, or something goes into a deeper dimension of our lives and really begin to deal with the causes. And one of the things I encourage you to steer clear of as we go through this together are symptoms. I'm going to be talking something about symptoms, particularly sex. I want to give a lot of accent to that because it is a constantly reoccurring sort of symptom. But the problem that we need to look at are the causal factors. So let's begin. I won't say this each time. I define a happy marriage as this. A good marriage, now everybody's hard to live with. If you had my job, you'd know that. Everybody is hard to live with. The difference in marriages is that some people give us enough good stuff to make living with them worthwhile, and some don't. A good marriage, therefore, is when I am living with somebody who's hard to live with, but gives me enough to make it worthwhile. Now, why do good marriages fail? I want to talk about three basic things. I want to talk about the problem of expectations. I want to talk about the problem of paradox. And I want to talk about the problem of perspective. So as I try to lay out the basic groundwork for this whole study, before we get into this thing of the 20-year itch and how to raise the little you and all that sort of thing, to say that good marriages fail because, number one, what are you expecting when you come into it? The hard part about this is that this needs some really real looking at, and it's hard for us to really kind of get our teeth into it. But I think I've come to see that probably the most single important question you can ask yourself in your marriage is, when I got married, what did I expect? The problem of expectation. Clifford Kirkland of the Indiana University says, when people get married, they are basically, intrinsically looking for two things. All of us seek two things in marriage: to continue the satisfaction of the family life we had as a child. Write that down. To continue the satisfaction of the family life we had as a child, and at the same time to make up for the deprivations we thought we suffered. Now, this is a problem of expectation. What did you expect out of your marriage? There's a girl whose father was successful, one of the most important men in town, but he didn't have enough time for her, just didn't spend time with her. And so when she gets married, to meet these two, to fulfill these two options or these two needs, she looks for someone who is very successful in town and yet who has a lot of time for her. And you begin to get into the problem of expectation. Then there's the young guy whose mother treated him like a spoiled brat all of his life, gave him everything he wanted, catered to his every need. And then when he gets married, I mean, she did nothing to motivate him. She did nothing to encourage him to excel. In fact, she did everything for him. And I see this guy from time to time in a dozen different dress. He's someone who has married somebody that really believed in him, that loved him, that thought he was the greatest guy in the world, but at the same time, and in some mysterious way, could motivate him to excel. What do you expect in marriage? You know, marriage was never intended to carry the baggage it has to carry. When you get into the whole process sociologically, it was instituted in the beginning to ensure survival, and then security, and then convenience. But then all of a sudden, and as we become much more aware of all that's around us, we begin saying, give me something that will make me grow up, that will meet every aesthetic need, every sensual need, every physical need, every emotional need. And that's a problem of expectation. All of us feel that we'll find a partner that will give us the things that we lost or missed or thought we had or thought we didn't have in our childhood. And that's a problem of expectation. Of course, another illustration of this, I'm just trying to illustrate these points now to get into it. Just take, for instance, this sexual thing. Now, you always expect a minister to say something that's kind of dumb and kind of fanatical, so let me just say it and get it out of the way. I am prepared to say that sex is here to stay. I just don't think you're going to rule it out. I don't think you're going to outlaw it. And I don't think it's the whole ball game. But I use it to illustrate this thing. Fully 80% of the counseling I have had to do in the last 18 years has to do with at least sexual problems as a symptom of the difficulties, a symptom of the malady. But the problem goes back more fundamentally to the fact of, what did you expect in marriage? And this is getting worse all the time, not better. Because look at the subliminal stimuli in our environment. Television. You know, I'm not a prude, but I can't believe what comes over this. I can't believe what comes into our own homes today. And you can't believe how that on a very subliminal level affects expectation in marriage. Playboy magazine. I was talking to somebody or reading somewhere the other day. This guy said to his wife, "says you need to do something about your figure." She said, "I did. I threw away all your Playboy magazines." That comes very, very close to the problem of subliminal stimuli. All the stuff we bring into our lives that puts such pressure on each other. You know, I think it was Herbert Zeroff who said that the problem that used to be in marriage or in sex was that it was a question of will she or won't she. But now it's a question of can she and will she. In other words, it's an Academy Award kind of thing now. And far more emphasis is being put on technique than compassion or caring or anything else. And I'm not getting ready to advocate a marriage that is droll and has no sexual excitement. In fact, I think a truly oriented marriage where people are not trying to get each other to meet the needs that are deep within their own psyche has a greater sexual life than you'll ever have in 100 affairs. And I've not necessarily had 100 affairs, but I've talked to a lot of people who have. And I'm here to report to you that they say that it's an insatiable context. It's the law of diminishing returns. It's just like getting a fix in anything. You may need 5 cubic cc's to give you a trip. Then you need 10 to maintain the original response. Then you need 20. Then you need 40. And so we keep looking for things, but all in a symptomatic form. And when you raise the question, what did you expect? Then you can begin to get into one of the main reasons good marriages fail. It's because we're not really dealing with the cause. We're not really looking at what we really expected and the will to grow up. Sex is a real problem today. It's why I'm going to talk a lot about it, especially as to some of the things that I find that really help in a marriage in dealing with it. But you know, you're just in a generation where you can't help that. I believe personally, in fact, I think it's a matter of history. Those of you who read history at all know that this thing of pornography, this thing of licentiousness, all this stuff, has always been a cyclical thing. I heard someone say many years ago that man has always taken women and dressed them to the hilt, and then over a cycle of 100 years began undressing them till he got them completely nude, and then he dressed them completely again and started the cycle all over again. Well, I was listening to a radio commentary this afternoon that says with women's lib this is going to change. They got a guy in Milwaukee now that'll jump out of a cake nude if you're interested in that sort of thing. I didn't get the address. But we're living in a day where there's a tremendous sexual orientation, and it's really different, and it's changing drastically. Well, you know, when I was a kid 25 years ago, talking about things you see, and everybody was all bent out of shape because in Gone with the Wind, Rhett Butler said, "frankly, my dear, I don't give a damn." Now they're saying heck and golly and shucks, and things have changed. The only thing we had to look forward to when I was a kid was National Geographic and Sears and Roebuck catalog. You know, if it hadn't been for National Geographic, I wouldn't have known nothing. Sears Roebuck was pretty good, but it wasn't nearly as good as some editions of National Geographic. But you know, the irony of that is, and this is succinctly to the point, and don't think I'm just filling in time, the irony of that is that in an uptight Victorian age, or even just the vestigial remnants of that, which was the wonderful 40s and 50s, there was less problems in marriage, in good marriages, that's what I'm talking about now, there were less problems in good marriages than there are now. And so the sexual revolution has had a tremendous effect on marital adjustment. When I deal with that section about sex isn't just for babies anymore, I want to put some graphs on the board and talk about, let me just say it the way I believe it's going to be, clinically what is happening psychologically in marriages today due to this subliminal stimuli, this kind of input. Joseph Epstein has written an interesting book, or a paper, entitled The Bedroom Olympics, where he tries to deal with this. But it is a problem of expectation. Now, I'm still on expectation, and I want to say that here is an even deeper problem that surrounds it. And this is my own feelings. This is what I've seen. This disorientation by expectation. Follow that now. This disorientation by expectation is often not faced squarely. We have in our lives, and each one is very, very different, a frustration threshold. And once we reach that frustration threshold, where we've got to mature and grow up, the tendency is to abdicate that responsibility, change institutions, and start all over again. I'd put it in this rule. All inspiration institutionalizes. Now, you don't have to write this down, but all inspiration institutionalizes. Anytime you are inspired, we tend to institutionalize that to maintain it. This is what church is all about. This is what college is all about. This is what marriage is all about. Okay, we tend to institutionalize. And in all institutionalization, there is a personal maturation ceiling which must be pushed through in order to continue the growth process. Changing institutions does not compensate or facilitate. Let me illustrate it. Sandra always says she understands what I'm talking about until I illustrate it, and then she's not sure, but let me try. And obviously, let me just say, a lot of what I'm going to say is redundant to some of you, and I'm not apologizing for that. In fact, I'm doing it deliberately for two reasons. It's the only thing I know. And secondly, I plan to expand on it broader than I have. But let me illustrate this principle, this expectation thing, and the frustration ceilings. When I was living in Miami, it was back in the time when there was still a lot of hippies, a lot of conflict, a lot of people walking around with placards waiting for something to write on it, you know. And down in Coconut Grove, which was at that time the hippie section of Miami, known to the other citizens of the town as the Miami Zoo, was a large segment of subculture people who decided that they were going to get out of our society, just get out completely. So they got up in a large banyan tree. Now, some of you Yankees and some of you North Floridians don't know what a banyan tree is, but you couldn't get one in this building if it was full grown. This colony of subculture types got up in a banyan tree to build a new society. And here they were with platforms, you know, all these Tarzan type things all over this banyan tree in the heart of Coconut Grove. But the interesting thing was, within about a month, half of them had climbed down out of that tree and had climbed up another tree to start a new society. And I kept driving by, you know, watching all these funny people up, and it's almost as interesting as going to church. And I'd look up in these trees, and by about the second month, now the Miami Herald was following this too, it was all in the papers, but by about the third month, some of the group in this tree had gotten down and started a third tree, a new society. Now, this is what I'm saying. In all institutionalization, there is a frustration ceiling. In other words, there is a place you can grow to without much trouble. If everything's going great, you don't have any problems. It requires no maturation on your part. You have a normal, natural frustration threshold. Now, the thing about this whole problem of expectation is, when we hit that thing, nobody wants to grow up. Nobody wants to have to deal with all these gross immaturities. And we hope we had found Mr. Wonderful or Miss Wonderful, and we hope we'd had the thing settled. But once you hit the frustration threshold, we either hang in there and see this thing through, and then break out into a new growth area where at a later stage we hit another frustration threshold. A lot of sociologists, a lot of anthropologists, a lot of behavioral psychologists speak of this in increments of 7, 14, 21. I think that's simplistic, but I see a lot of evidence of the fact that there must be something clinical. Nobody really understands it. It just is an obvious kind of thing that there are distinct increments where every marriage has its worst times. 7:14-21, just for the sake of being simplistic, but yet getting at something that you can put your teeth into. See, one of the problems that's bothered me that I really plan to stick my neck out on is to try to say some of this so that it's really helpful. Everybody has a frustration threshold. The tendency is to get out of the tree, get in another tree, and start all over again. But the problem psychologically is that when you do that, the initial frustration threshold in the next relationship comes sooner. In the third tree, you get put out with the institution sooner yet. And in the fourth tree, sooner yet. It's been my observation that an awful lot of personal problems that are not dealt with at the initial frustration threshold, an awfully lot of those problems require four marriages before they're worked out, quote, on their own. But this is the frustration threshold. Ministers all have these problems with their churches. Marriages is very definitely like this. Very often someone will come into my office. They're not members of this church because everybody in this church is very saintly and has no problems at all. That's one of the requirements we make before we receive members. But there are a lot of people in this town, and inevitably somebody will come into me and they'll say, I want to tell you this before you hear from somebody else. Our happy marriage is breaking up. We've been married 14 years. You wouldn't believe how many times I hear that. You wouldn't believe how many times I hear we've been married 21 years. But we're going to get out, and I'm going to marry my secretary. And my response initially, and I've said this to one or two of you, my response initially has been twofold. Number one, I understand that because your wife is as old as you are, and you know how bad that is. Secondly, I have seen your secretary, and I understand that. But thirdly, I would like to suggest that you're going to have to grow up someday anyway. You might as well do it where you are and save all that alimony. This thing of just changing trees. You see, let me go back to the rule. All inspiration institutionalizes. And in all institutionalizing, there is a personal maturation ceiling which must be broken through in order to continue our growth. And changing institutions does not compensate or facilitate. Now, obviously, there are some people who are wrongly married. But I want to get on in a minute to say that most initial marriages are the best bet you're going to have, in my opinion. But stay there. Break through it. Head on toward a new ceiling. The happy homes I see are those who know that in between maturation ceilings, they are each other's best friends. They're in love. They have an affinity and a depth for one another and a respect and a caring that you're not going to get as you continue to change institutions. And someday, in the 17th tree, before you even stand up, you bumped your head on the same ceiling that you wouldn't go through way back when. The problem of expectation. When you went into marriage, what did you think it was going to be like, and what was it supposed to make up for in your life? This is groundwork. Number two is paradox. Paradox is something that looks one way, but doesn't seem to be just right. It has a funny taste to it, a funny feeling. And marriage is a paradox from the very beginning. Michael Novak of Syracuse University has an interesting statement. People say of marriage that it's boring, when what they really mean is that it terrifies them. Too many and too deep are its searing revelations, its angers, its hates, and its loves. They say of marriage that it is deadening, when what they mean is that it drives us beyond adolescent fantasies and romantic dreams. No tame project, marriage. It begins as a paradox. Much of what we feel about it, I'm not going to get married, it's dumb. That's paradoxical, has nothing to do with what we really feel. And when you get into it, good homes probably have more difficulty with paradox, certainly, than bad homes. I don't know who put it this way. I saw it years and years ago, But take the average marriage, take the average good marriage. Let's say, let's give it a lifeline running from when you met him to when you died or whenever it is that you broke up. And I saw it explained this way one time, and it was helpful to me. In a mediocre marriage, there are mediocre highs, there are mediocre lows, there are mediocre highs, there are mediocre lows, there are mediocre... run-of-the-mill, mundane marriages, especially if they were just like your mom and dad's and you don't know any better, don't tend to have the searing, searing difficult times that good marriages do. Because when you have really peak experiences, there's almost a corresponding drop in that, nowhere near as smooth as this. But it's something of this kind of paradox. And there's a price you pay. If marriage is not all that great and not all that good, there's a price you pay for that. But the thing that I'm finding so very, very important in our lives for us to begin to understand is that a lot of good marriages are not making it because people can't get it straight in their minds that when you have great times, you're going to have bad times because you compare one with the other. And you know, the thing I'm hearing more often now than almost anything else is that it used to be so good. Used to be so good. And we want it, you see, a lot of that corresponds with the maturation ceiling. And we start wanting to bail out. And they start wanting us to bail out. And they start wanting to bail out. And all this time, if you really get into it, if you can really get the person to talk to you, you find them saying, "But I can't live with what I've got because it's been so terrific. It's been so really very, very great." So you see, discontent arises from comparing the marriage relationship with itself at better moments. I was thinking about it today. Alabama coming to town. You heard about that? Now at Alabama, when they have a 9-2 season, everybody's upset. I would bet if Florida could have a 9-2 season this year, nobody would be upset. You see, that's paradox. At Alabama, if they have a 10-1 season, Bear starts saying, "Next year we're going to rebuild." Vandy, when Steve Sloan was over there, and what did they go, 5-4, and then went to a bowl somewhere, the Kleenex Bowl or something they were involved. I was in Nashville around that time. You would have thought, it was the greatest thing in the whole world. You see, when we find somebody that we love and things are exciting and meaningful, there is a deep paradox. And I do not believe, though laying the groundwork is so tough, I do not believe you can really get into how to deal with some of these things until we begin to realize that we're living in a very unique day. Our expectations, the subliminal stimuli that teaches us what to expect sexually, maritally, every other way, is causing us to reach some very real peak experiences and causing some very real dilemma in our lives. Let me read this to you. Herbert Zeroff, I think, is head of the marriage clinic of somewhere in North Carolina. "Couples lucky enough to have these moments, these high moments, are unable to sustain them and at the same time unable to settle for ordinary moments. They want life to be constantly satisfying." You know, this is another part of one of our new problems, is that we want it now. We want it to be satisfying in every sense, and not to have to work, and particularly not to have to grow up and break through these ceilings. "But to achieve a constant state, to avoid the valleys, it is necessary to eliminate the peaks." And I know couples who do that. I know couples, I have worked with couples, who carefully guard, like the alcoholics say, "Don't get too glad or too sad." But you see, there again, people who enjoy life enjoy marriage. People who don't enjoy life don't tend to enjoy marriage, because if you don't want to run the risk, if you don't want to take the chance, and if you can't live with winning the national championship 1 year and then going 7-3 the next year, then the only option you've got, if just feeling good is the big God in your life, is to keep changing trees. Because everybody else has to grow up. They want life to be constantly satisfying, but to achieve a constant state, to avoid the valleys, it's necessary to eliminate the peaks, which puts the marriage on a narrow band of involvement. Good marriages are not like that, but the price they exact can be very, very high. So, when you think about the problem of paradox, remember when you start saying, and this is particularly easy to talk about on these graphs in the sex thing in a couple of weeks, but when you start saying, remember how it used to be and why can't things be like they were, all the pounding on the doors of time cannot bring back that which has caused your problem right now, and that's the good things you've experienced. And you know, this is one of the problems with extramarital activity. Things happen that in these relationships that are always peak because nobody is growing up there. And when you're not growing up, your whole system is much more stimulative and titillating. And people have peak experiences in marriage or outside of marriage that often cause great consternation within a good marriage, because they can't adjust to how they've had a fix. And just to live in a life that has the roller coaster effect is hard on all of us. Another paradox, I'm still talking about paradox, is the neurosis that attracts us. Now, I've only shared this theory with one person, someone in this church whom I deeply respect. And you're the next, both of you. I believe, I have observed, and my mother thinks I see right, I have observed that most people make their best choice of marriage initially because in their initial choice, their psyche, their deep subconscious says to them, that person over there really can meet your greatest needs. Now, Temple University has run a lot of research at the point of communication. It really has to do with verbal communication, but they have found that 7% that in a congregation, say a church service on Sunday or a class, 7% of what they understand me to say, they get from the words I use. 7%. 38% of what I convey to them is how I say it. And 55% is totally nonverbal. Okay, now put that within the context of what I'm talking about. And the person you fell in love with wasn't so much because of appearance, and it certainly wasn't what they said. But there was 92% of that involvement as you saw them for the first time. And most of you can remember when that was. When you saw them for the first time, I believe that there was something deep down inside that says, this person can meet my deepest need. Okay, but now the problem comes in like this, and I put it in three stages. I call the first one the intuitive stage. And I'll use my hands. Here is ortho, and by real affirmation, everybody's hard to live with. And getting out of one banyan tree and going to another is not going to change that, except in a few very isolated cases. The first person in your life who really says to you, that may not even be the first person you marry, I'm only confusing it at this point, but the first person in your life where it says to you, this person can really help me, means that you've got some tough growing up to do. Now, there are some basic ways of dealing with that. And there are some things that can be suggested that are really very helpful. I think this 50% thing is just sort of an example. But let's begin at this point. Good marriages often fail because of the problem of expectation and paradox and perspective. I close with this. Ernest Haverman, who has done a lot of writing on this article and on this subject of marriage and family, talks about Art and Annie. I just love this little statement. Now, Art and Annie, this is an illustration of more of the problems that come from disillusionment. But you see, good marriages have more disillusionment than bad marriages. I mean, when you don't get above the compendium, disillusionment's a part of a good marriage. He says, the wedding dress is folded away. The love nest in the suburbs turns out to have a leaky roof, crabgrass, a mortgage that burns up every second paycheck. The babies are not the dimpled darlings of the ads, but emperor's tyrants who have to be bottled, burped, and changed, and later agonized over. The groom, alas, never earns that $1 million. His wife loses her figure. There are moments when he would like to run away to Australia and moments when she wished she had become a nun. And still, you see them in Florida or on porches up north. An old man reading the newspaper through a magnifying glass and an old woman wearing sandals to ease her aching arches. In a little while, they will eat supper and then watch television, each knowing exactly what the other's thinking until it's time for bed. And through the long night, each will rest content because the other is there. They're in love. They've always been in love, although sometimes they would have denied it. And because they've always been in love, they have survived everything that life could throw at them, even their own failures. This is what kept Art and Annie together, for all their disparities. This is what is meant by a happy marriage. Someone's defined true love as this. Perhaps true love can best be recognized by the fact that it thrives under circumstances which would blast anything else into small pieces. And what I'm trying to say tonight is that one of the greatest tests of love is having it good. Having position, or just affection. And I really urge you, I really caution you to know that good marriages are the ones that you know were good when you hear the person say, we finally got a divorce, and I look back on it now, and if I had it to do over again, I know that whatever we had to go through was not as bad as what I'm now living in. Because they knew they passed up something that they were never going to find again, very probably. A good marriage that, like any other maturation process, has a demand on our lives that we grow up and that we come to grips with all these little people that are inside. Next week, I don't know what, we knew the registration was very high this week. Next week we plan to meet in the telephone booth over in the fellowship hall. But for those of you who are there, I want to talk specifically about what I think is probably the most common problem of our day in marriage, and that is the little you. These little people still within us that cause so much of our anxiety. And what really can be done about that? And I've got some that are horrendous little beasts within me. And I've found some very helpful things in my marriage and in my life. And I want to share those with you. Just two quick announcements. One is, because this is an extra night of our Lay Academy, that is the programs, for those of you who don't attend this church, the classes we have throughout the week, Bible study and what have you, we don't have budget for our babysitters. So as you leave this evening, drop a quarter or a a dollar or 50-cent piece in those mission boxes out there so we can pay. If we get enough to cover the whole session, we won't bother you with it again. But we do need some help on that because there's no budget for it. Secondly, there are tapes available on this series as per our usual process if you are interested in any of those. But I thank you for coming. I will say that this has been the most frightening experience that I've ever undertaken in my own ministry. But I'm determined to be vulnerable and to risk my own ego and to have evenings or times or moments that are not all that ecstatic and marvelous, because this is darn good material and it'll help you if you'll give it a chance. Thank you and good night.